Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later in the hour, readers have been inspired by Harry Potter and his friends for 20 years now, and some readers take the books very seriously. The podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text certainly does, and it's coming to Iowa. We'll preview the upcoming live podcast event that asks, in these trying times, what would Hermione do? But first, Karen Bender's latest collection of short stories not only captures so much of this moment in history, it also makes her seem clairvoyant. The collection was released just 10 days after the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and the first story in the collection is called Where to Hide in a Synagogue. The whole collection deals with contemporary issues with humanity, moments of humor and pathos. Bender is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. She's also taught at the program, and she was a finalist for the National Book Award for her short story collection, Refund. She's also the author of two novels, and she is on the line with me now. Wow. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I do want to start with that first story in the collection, Where to Hide in a Synagogue. And I know that you have selected a passage from that story to read to us. Why don't you set that up for us and give us a taste of it?
Yeah. So Where to Hide in a Synagogue, actually, suddenly I feel a little nervous about reading a passage because it just is such a raw story for me. I think I'll just talk about it,
okay.
The story actually started when I was driving carpool for my daughter a few years ago, and she and a friend were talking about how they wondered what to do if there was a shooter in a movie theater, and this was after the Aurora shooting. So they said, would it be better to duck, or would it be better to run? So I remember hearing this and just feeling horrified, and I just thought, I have to write about this, because to deal with chaos is how I deal with chaos. So basically, I started like a flash fiction kind of how to hide in a movie theater. And then Charlottesville happened, and there was the rally of white supremacists shouting, Jews will not replace us. And then there was, I was reading about it, I wondered what was happening with the synagogue in Charlottesville at that time. And I read that there were armed guys that were surrounding it, and they had to leave out the back, you know, to avoid violence. And I just saw that, and was just really terrified. And so I thought, I have to set this story in a synagogue, because there's now a lot of violence, targeting Jews that is different from any that I've seen in my lifetime in the United States. So basically, the way I wanted to sort of look at this is through my own fictional lens and looking at how I thought two temple members were tasked with. I'll just read the first paragraph of the story. Which is, everyone agreed on the name, the Advisory Board for Safety and Well-Being. The committee would be composed of me and Eva Silverman, and today we would walk through the synagogue discussing strategies to help temple members in the event of an attack. Together, we would come up with a list of suggestions and write a preliminary report. It was a clear day in early October, and though the air still held the faint heat of summer, I thought I could feel the underbreath of chill in the air. We lived in North Carolina. Charlottesville was 4 hours away. I arrived at Bethlehem Synagogue 15 minutes early. I did not wait in front of the synagogue for a reason I did not want to explain, but that felt entirely right. I walked to the entrance of the sanctuary, but did not stay there long. Then I wandered into the parking lot. I belonged to the synagogue for 35 years. My shoulders braced a little as the cars rushed past me. I wondered as they drove by what the drivers were looking for and what they would see. And I guess what I wanted to look at is what are kind of the ways that that Jews or anyone, you know, actually in a public place that feels vulnerable, are trying to cope with the constant violence of gun violence today.
Well, and just like talking about your daughter and her friends strategizing, talking about what they would do if they were in a movie theater where there was a shooting. I mean, we know that many students have had those conversations about, you know, where they sit in the cafeteria and how vulnerable they are in the case of a school shooting. Mm-hmm. And so many of those conversations are based on fallacies and fantasies about what we could do in a situation like that. And there's so much of that in your story, because I think we all know that we would be incredibly vulnerable. There's very little we can do, really, to protect ourselves.
Right. And so there's a kind of absurdity of being human in this time of vulnerability. In the story, in the setting, in being Jewish. So So people said that the story was prescient, but I was thinking about that, and I thought, well, a writer's job is really to be alert, you know, keep your eyes open and see what's going on, and really that's all of our jobs, you know, the how can we be alert in this really kind of troubling time, and kind of, you know, really see what's going on.
When you heard about that synagogue shooting, the massacre, again, I mean, that was timed so closely to the release of your book. What was your reaction?
Well, it was shock and horror, and also I was not surprised, because you could see this building over months. You know, a lot of rhetoric toward you know, so many groups, including Jews, and you know, the shooter had been responding to one of Trump's tweets about George Soros. You know, so the president himself was spreading this rhetoric. So, I was just mad. I just am still so mad.
There's another element to this story, and this friendship between these two women. These women have been very close in the past.
Right.
They have shared many, many different things in their lives, many big events as their children have grown, and losing a husband, a divorce, all of these different things their friendship has weathered. And yet there is this distance between them.
Right.
And I think that is something that is very of the moment in the United States right now as well, where wherever we come down politically, a lot of friendships have been damaged because of our political beliefs in a way that I guess I haven't experienced in the past. I don't think a lot of people have experienced in the past. This is such a polarizing moment. Was that something else you were trying to convey?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think the idea is I wanted to look at different sorts of violence in the story. There was the violence coming from the outside, and then there was also kind of the violence between them in their friendship. The fact that one of them was kind of denying what was going on, and you know, and so I think that is something that is real. Yeah.
You also approach such a difficult, terrifying, heartbreaking subject. And you do this in so many of your stories with absurdist humor at the same time. And when we see how ridiculous these women are being as they're trying to decide, okay, if this is the safest part of the synagogue, then who should be allowed to sit there?
Mm-hmm.
And they're thinking through what people wear and, you know, their age how much money they might give to the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, we're looking in a mirror in so many ways. But so in juxtaposing humor with these terrifying topics, you tackle a lot of terrifying topics. How does that come about? Is that something you do to keep yourself sane?
That's a great question. I view everything through a view of kind of absurdism and humor. Ultimately, I think, you know, humor works best in literature and fiction, you know, when it's when it's born of feeling, you know, when it's not just like a little ha ha joke. It's born of deep feeling, and really the deep feeling that it's born of here is fear. But then all the sort of crazy things that people do to cope with fear in a way of maintaining control, which is really human. So I think that's in a way I think humor and irreverence is a wonderful way to humanize all characters, because we're all doing crazy things to cope.
Yeah. Would these stories do feel so contemporary, so of the moment, although some of them take place in the past? I'm curious about the period of time that you wrote them in. When did you start working on this collection?
Yeah, so I started writing the stories after I finished Refund, so that was 2015, like late 2014, early 2015. And the first story I wrote was Three Interviews, which was kind of continuing the themes of Refund, which were economic insecurity and unemployment, and and Three Interviews was looking at the experience of trying to get hired.
And character goes on three ridiculous job interviews in one day.
Right. And so so that was kind of expanding that. And then the next one I started was Mrs. America, which was actually I was curious about writing a character that was inspired by someone like Sarah Palin. You know, how does a character compartmentalize terrible behavior and lies in order to advance themselves? So I started that, and then Trump started running. And actually, I do see a clear line between Sarah Palin and Trump. And what I just looked and I thought, wow, this is just surreal, you know, seeing all this happen. And then I remember after he was elected, I felt this grief at the country that I had never felt quite the same way, and I felt grief for people, but not for the country. And I thought, this is a really strong emotional reaction. I've got to kind of figure this out, and that led to the Good Mothers in the Parking Lot, that story. So, and then I do write to figure things out, either internally or externally, something that I find really troubling. So I started writing the other stories in response to things that were going on.
All right, we're
going to
take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Karen Bender. She is the author of the collection of short stories called The New Order. And we will continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll be talking to podcast co-host Vanessa Zoltan and Chloe Angel, who's a contributing editor at Marie Claire. She lives in Iowa City, and they are going to be co-hosting an event in Iowa City next week, a live podcast event for the podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. They'll be asking, in these trying times, what would Hermione do? We'll find out more in a few minutes. With me now, that laugh comes from Karen Bender, who is the author of a collection of short stories called The New Order, most recently. She's also a novelist and has written other short stories. And Karen, just before the break, you were talking about how writing these stories over the last 3 years or two years, 2015, 2016, was a way for you to process what was going on in our society right now at this moment. And that's why this collection feels so of this moment. But I want to go back in time. If processing what's going on in your life is turning to writing is how you do that, when did that start for you?
When did I start writing?
Yeah. When did that become your way of dealing with what's going on in the world?
Well, I have an essay that addresses this called, this is in the New York Times a few years ago, called The Accidental Writer, which sort of explains the story of when I started writing when I was actually six, and I was at a birthday party in Los Angeles, where I grew up, and a birthday boy was running away, trying to avoid being put through the spanking machine, which was where kids would stand in a row and, like, spank the birthday kid, and he didn't want to be spanked. So all these kids are running after him. He picks up a big rock, and he throws it, and it kind of hurled through the air, and then it hit me right above the eye. Oh. And so I fell backwards, and a parent picked me up and took me to the birthday cake table and put me down and had to move the birthday cake so it wouldn't get bloody. And so I remember that line in my head, and it was a way, it was like my first writerly line, you know, I think, and that I wanted to control the situation in some way, and I created a narrative, which was the Day of the Rock. And so in that, I was the protagonist, and the boy was an antagonist, and then the story was a narrative arc. And I do feel like writing stories is a way of controlling chaos, is a way of controlling what is difficult in life, and I have found it a comfort to me my whole life.
You've written two collections of short stories. You've also written novels. What draws you to writing short stories? If this is a way to deal with life, I mean, are short stories sort of perfect for that? Because you don't have to delve as deeply.
I do love stories in that they are shorter and that you can go in and out of them. I mean, stories can take a long time, too. I mean, I've had stories that have taken, you know, 2 years to write or more sometimes. I think, but in order to respond to things, you know, going on, I think that form it can be very useful.
You have selected another portion of a story to read to us today. This is from the story Department of Happiness and Reimbursement. And this is a dystopian future story.
Yeah.
Maybe not too far in our future. why don't you read a little bit for us from that story?
Yeah, so this story, just a tiny bit of background, is I wrote this story in response to... it was kind of a response to Me Too and also to non-disclosure agreements, you know, that I read about with Bill O'Reilly and a lot of these guys who, you know, gave these big payouts to women and who they'd been accused of harassing and then told them, and then they were not allowed to talk about it, the woman. So I found this weird, and I just thought, what would it be like to if the government actually institutionalized this idea? So this is just the beginning of it. The Department of Happiness and Reimbursement. The first time I went to 140 Standard Street, the location of my new office, I walked slowly, observing the many people in business suits, moving through the skyscraper's long, cool shadows, and I wondered, passing by them, which workers were real. There were messengers on bikes weaving around the pedestrians. There were people carrying large cardboard boxes out of trucks and into stores. The general sense of noise and activity made it seem that our country was productive and busy. I was surprised at the activity because I'd been told that many of the downtown buildings were empty, that lights were set in a timer to wink on and off to simulate people inside these offices. There were rumors that some were hired to pretend to walk in and out of buildings to make it appear that labor was ongoing. I tried to guess who had a job and who was only wearing a costume. I wondered if the newness of their suits would tip me off, or the way they clutched their cups of coffee, or the vacant quality of their stares. We all regarded one another warily, wondering who here had a purpose and who was imitating those who did. But the distinctions didn't matter. All of us were, I knew, glad to be allowed downtown. It was better, we thought, than an alternative, and we walked across the sidewalk swiftly, faces set in expressions that did not reveal our fear.
So that's a little bit of the story. And that one is the Department of Happiness and Reimbursement from the collection The New Order by Karen Bender. And that hints, of course, as at the employment situation that people are in this future. So your protagonist is this young woman who is fairly fresh out of college, and she gets a job, which is a huge coup at this, you know, in this future. And she's also locked into that job because there aren't other jobs available.
Right.
And describe for me what her job is.
Yeah, so in my vision for this world, so very few people get jobs, and when they do, they have to stay in them, because if people actually knew what they were like, they wouldn't actually want them, and actually maintaining a level of hope is important. So Her job is to give, you know, they'll write in complaints, you know, of like terrible bosses or working conditions, and she'll give them a one-time financial reimbursement, you know, to kind of pay them off, and then they can't talk about it anymore.
Right. So they're allowed to complain one time.
Yeah, one.
That is your one opportunity to complain. They
yeah.
put a dollar amount on that, send yeah. you a letter, make a phone call, and you're done. You're still locked in that job. Nothing
right.
has changed.
Right.
But you can no longer talk about it. And whatever the monetary amount is that they've decided on, that's what you get.
That's it. And it's not very much. And then she's moved to the department that focuses on sexual harassment complaints, which have skyrocketed, and those reimbursements are tiny because there's so many. So you know, she'll give people like, you know, $20 or something, you know, and that's it. And so then a woman wants more. She wants justice, and then
things go from there.
Things go from there. Yeah. So that was really interesting one for me to write, and. Yeah.
It's you mentioned that it grew out of, you know, we hear all of these stories about mm-hmm. men in particular in positions sure. of power who have harassed women who work with them or for them. And then there's a settlement. And of course, we've seen some of those men fall from grace. But obviously, it gives us an indication that this is a pretty common practice. So there are lots and lots of stories we haven't heard about. So was that
right.
was that what launched you on this journey, thinking about all of those voices that we'll never hear, those stories that will not be told?
Oh, great question. Yeah, I mean, I think that was probably in my consciousness. Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting in the story, the toll that it takes, not just on the main mm-hmm. protagonist, but she's in a department with three other women who are doing the same thing. They're all 20-something women. And
right.
they're all getting these complaints and processing them. They don't get to decide how much each complaint is worth, but it's their job to call and
right.
let the person know, you know, your sexual harassment is worth $63. Mm-hmm. We'll be sending that out.
Right.
And the emotional right. toll that it took on those women was mm-hmm. really interesting. The women that are experiencing mm-hmm. these things vicariously. Why do you think that's worth exploring?
Oh, I think, yeah, that's a great observation on the story. So I think I did want to look at that because of the way that so many people end up doing things that they don't really believe in their work just because they have to hold on to their job. And I think, you know, you look at, you know, or you know, how people enable, you know, things. You look at Harvey Weinstein, right? And, you know, how many people were... I don't know how many actually knew what was going on, how many kind of suspected, but there were a lot of people, including women, that were, you know, implicated in that.
Also, with all of the news breaking that is part of the Me Too movement,
yeah.
do you feel like that takes a toll on people just hearing these stories?
That's a great point. I mean, I think it's really incredible that it's being talked about, and that there have been effects on people, and there, you know, is an increasing awareness, and hopefully it will stop. I think it is in there, and it's, you know, people and start having reliving all these things, and it is difficult.
One of the other stories in the collection, I mentioned some of them take place in the past, and mm-hmm. it's this one started, I think, in the 70s or 80s mm-hmm. With a school shooting then yeah. where someone came into the school and shot two people, including one student and one teacher, mm-hmm. and the aftermath of that, the mm-hmm. way that stays with your characters who were there, although not involved, the way that it stays with them through their entire life is what you explore. And how did that story come to you?
That story evolved a lot of different ways. I really like writing about women's friendships. I think, you know, I'm a huge fan of Elena Ferrante and, you know, her exploration of those dynamics. And I wanted to write about that, and then I wanted to write about a misunderstanding, and in a sense, the story hooks on a misunderstanding which was inspired by an Alice Munro story called Fiction, which also is based a little bit on that. So I wanted to look at that, and I wanted to see how I could take a character through an event that happens, you know, in middle school and in orchestra, and then how it affects them later.
That is the title story of the collection,
yeah,
called The New Order.
Yeah.
And I was struck by the interaction. So this horrible event happens when these two women are in ninth grade, and then they don't have any communication with each other for decades.
Yeah. Right.
And they reconnect at this point. And exploring how they both remember things differently, mm-hmm. and how these small actions had incredible impact on each other. I found that to be fascinating, but also, again, so true when we think about how we process things in our teenage brains and how we hold on to different kinds of pain. There are so many elements in so many of your stories where there is a moment in the past that affects someone for the rest of their life in sometimes really surprising ways. Is that a theme that you like to come back to again and again?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm very psychologically oriented. You know, I have a lot of psychology. I was a psychology major in college, and a lot of my family members are involved in the helping professions. And I really, it's kind of my worldview, you know, how do things happen in the past that then expand out, you know, over and over? And they do in different ways. And different people's, you know, memories can also change over time, which is so interesting. So, yeah, that's something that's, I think, in really so much of my work. Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about the final story in this collection, which is called The Cell Phones. Mm-hmm. And after taking me on this ride in so many, you know, difficult stories that are of this moment that feel very real, I was surprised that you left me feeling hopeful.
Oh, good.
with the last story. And the premise of the cell phones is, again, we're back in synagogue, and people's phones just keep going off, and they're answering their phones, and they can't get it to stop, and they keep yelling at the people on the other side of the phone. They have to stop, and it doesn't stop, but they discover a way to stop it. So tell me what that's about.
Well, that story I wrote actually way before. I think it was one of the first stories I wrote after Refund, and it was it actually was sparked by the fact that my own cell phone did go off during High Holy Day services once, and I was just mortified, and I just thought I do have to write about this somehow, and so I wrote that story originally, and then at the end of editing it, my editor Dan Smetanka said, well, you know, this story it should kind of go into more of the divisions of the country. You know, can you develop that more in the story, which made sense. And I think it was good to leave the collection on a more hopeful note, because ultimately I am hopeful. I do feel that we can, you know, the country can change, that we can work together.
And the way they get their phones to stop ringing is
by
actually listening. And acknowledging that they've heard. They don't have to fix the problem. They don't have to come to an agreement. But just acknowledging that they've heard what the person on the other end of the phone is saying. Is that also, I know that you like to be involved in political campaigns. You like to canvass door to door. Is that idea born out of that work?
I think it is just about communication. I'm really interested in, you know, what's effective communication, and listening is so hard to do, and people are so eager not to do it. So actually to mirror someone and say, yes, I hear you, especially in social media, you know, you look at Twitter or you look at Facebook, and things can go badly so quickly because people just don't want to really acknowledge what someone's saying. And also hear what's underneath it. I do feel like a lot of what's going on in the country is there's a lot of unacknowledged pain that needs to be unpacked.
All right. Well, and you're helping a lot of us through a catharsis with your book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Thank you so much.
Karen Bender is the author most recently of the short story collection, The New Order. Her previous short story collection was shortlisted for the National Book Award. She was a finalist for the National Book Award for Refund. She's also the author of a couple of novels and a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. She also taught at the program. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to preview a live podcast event that's coming to Iowa next week. It's going to be in Iowa City. The podcast is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And the subject of the event is, in these trying times, what would Hermione do? So we'll ask that question in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.